You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter does the work for you. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other services may overwhelm you with applications to sift through, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/URDER. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good evening. Angela was stabbed 44 times. This was personal. On a November morning in 2015, Christopher Jackson waited for his fiancée, Angela Wilder, to pick him up from work as she always did. But this time she didn't show, and Christopher's calls went unanswered. The police found what looked like a scene from a horror movie at their home. The back door kicked in, a bedroom splattered with blood, and a pregnant young woman violently stabbed to death. Could Christopher have murdered the woman he claimed to love? Or was the crime done by an intruder Angela had feared for weeks? Angela's womanizing ex-husband Richie Wilder Jr. aimed detectives straight towards Christopher. The evidence, however, pointed squarely at Richie. Kindergarten teacher Cynthia Wilder thought her dreams had come true when she married Richie. But while her husband sat behind bars, Cynthia grew lonely. When she shared some disturbing details with a former lover, Cynthia finally revealed the truth behind the sinister plot to kill Angela Wilder. After 4 years of lies and deceit, the real story would shock a community to its very core. The book that we're featuring this evening is Wilder Intentions, Love, Lies, and Murder in North Dakota, with my special guest journalist and author, C.J. Wynn. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, C.J. Wynn.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much for joining us with this remarkable book and remarkable case. Just to open, I wanted to know how you came to this case, and maybe you have this opportunity to talk about the assistance you received from author, best-selling author, Shanna Hogan.
Sure. So I'm originally from North Dakota, and while I don't still live there, you know, many friends still live there. A lot of my family still lives there. And so I had heard about this case. It was being talked about on social media. They were doing a Dateline episode about it in August of 2018. And so being someone who watches every Dateline episode, of course, you know, I caught the episode, and then I just kind of decided from there that there had to be more to the story than what was presented in the 60-minute episode of Dateline. Right. And so I actually reached out to Shanna Hogan, who is one of my favorite true crime authors. I'd never met her before. And I just sent her an email and asked her if she could maybe give me some pointers on how to get started in writing true crime. And to my surprise, she responded back within just a few days, and we set up a meeting. And so she kind of gave me some pointers. She had just finished writing her fourth book, was getting ready to get that published. She had just finished that. And so she kind of had some open time and so kind of decided that she wanted to take on, you know, mentoring me through the process. So she was an excellent person to go to anytime I ran into any issues, any questions I had. So she was instrumental in all of that.
Now, that's obviously she recognized your passion for writing and your potential. Let's get to November 12, 2015, and you introduced the central characters, Christopher Jackson, and he works at Walmart, and his fiancée, as we introduced in the introduction, Angela Wilder, calls him at work, or they talk at work. So what is the gist of the conversation specifically when they talk? What is she telling him is going on around the house that night?
Sure. So he worked overnight shifts at Walmart from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. And it was pretty standard that they talked all throughout the night, whether it was text message or calling. He would call her on his first break, his second break, his third break, and then they would kind of text in between. Usually it was just to say hi, just to make sure Angela was doing okay. They had a young son at home with them. She had just found out she was pregnant again at this time on November 12, 2015. But on this particular night, the conversation was a little bit different. She was a little bit nervous. She thought that she heard noises coming from outside. She thought that someone was maybe even trying to jiggle the door open, the front door to their house.
Right.
And so he just kind of told her, hey, it's okay. Don't worry. It's probably just the neighbors. Not a big deal.
So they also promised, or he promised her too, that he would call again. She complained about being tired, and he knew she was overworked, but trying to do these nursing classes and also be taking care of the children and pregnant. So he knew that her being tired was justified. So what happened with their correspondence during his shift at Walmart?
Sure. So just like always, he called her on his first break at midnight, and then he called her again on his lunch break at 2 a.m., and they talked for a few minutes. And then when he called her on his third break at 5 a.m., she did not answer the phone anymore. And he thought it was kind of strange, but, you know, like you had mentioned, he knew that she was stressed out about school. She was tired. She had just found out she was pregnant, so she was kind of already feeling those, you know, initial signs. And so he thought, you know, she probably had just fallen asleep. He wanted to let her get her rest. In fact, he then text messaged her at about 5:13 a.m. and then said, you know, I hope you're getting some rest, sweetheart. I love you. I'll see you in a few hours. And then
go ahead.
I was going to say, and then she was scheduled to pick him up at 7 a.m. that morning, and he still could not get in touch with her. She still was not answering the phone even at that time.
Okay, so he gets in a cab and gets back home. What does he notice right away, and what does he see? What does he discover?
So he kind of starts to theorize with himself. Maybe her phone fell on the floor. Maybe it's buried underneath some blankets, and she's just, you know, sleeping hard. And so he didn't really know if he should be kind of annoyed with her or if he should be just more understanding that, you know, that she needed her rest. And so, yeah, like you said, he got into a cab, got home. It was about a seven-minute drive till they got to their house. And the cab driver actually ended up missing their house and actually parked into the driveway of the neighbor's house, which their bedroom, Christopher and Angela's bedroom window actually overlooked that driveway. And so when he got out of the cab, he kind of used the opportunity to be a little funny. And so he started knocking on their bedroom window thinking, well, if she's sleeping, that's definitely going to wake her up. But he did that a couple more times and she still didn't come to the window, still wasn't answering any text messages. So he kind of went around the other side of the house where her car was in their own driveway. And I think almost subconsciously, Christopher thought to himself that if the car was warm, there was a chance that maybe she had just woken up late. Maybe she'd gone out to start the car, but realized she was going to be too late to pick him up anyways and just gone back in. So, but then he touched the car and the car was cold. And then that's kind of when something hit him that something might be wrong. So then he turned around and looked at their house and found that their back door was actually standing wide open.
Now he yelled for his wife, Angela, or his fiance, and no response. Why did he not run in and see what the welfare of his son and his wife was? And What did he do then?
So as he walked towards the door, he did notice that it appeared to have been kicked in. It wasn't just standing open on its own. It hadn't just been opened and just blown open. It had been kicked in. The lock mechanism was stripped out of the wood in the door. And so, like you said, yep, he did yell in there. And I think to him, he just felt something wasn't right. And he recognized, and I think he was afraid. He was terrified that if he went in there, he was going to find something he didn't want to see. And so what he ended up doing is he just stepped right back out and called 911.
So police arrive. They want to make sure that he does not go into this house regardless, mm-hmm. and they need to make a welfare check. So that's what this is about. They go inside. Everything is clean and immaculate, but there's a locked bedroom door. They eventually have to kick mm-hmm. that door down. What do they find? What's the state of Angela in that room?
So when they first walk in, the house was immaculately clean. There was no sign of any kind of a struggle. They kicked the bedroom door down, and they walked in, and they found that even though the linens on the bed were kind of rumpled and messed up, there was nobody in the bed. But as they walked further in, they could see that there were numerous blood stains on the sheets. There were blood stains soaked into the sheets where Angela probably would have been laying while she was sleeping. There were blood stains on the pillow where her head was probably. And then as they walked further around the side of the bed, they saw Angela Wilder's body on the floor. She was lying in a pool of blood, and essentially her entire body was covered with blood and what they eventually determined were stab wounds.
Now, they obviously know that this is a serious crime scene. They have to secure that. Sergeant Dave Goodman is called from the officer, mm-hmm. Ruel, that was at the scene. And again, like I said, they secured the scene and made sure that the Christopher didn't do anything, mm-hmm. regardless of his protestations anyway. And then they also right away had the called the deputy state attorney, Kelly Dillon, to get a search warrant. Mm-hmm. So that was all taken care of. And then also the issue of the small son, Carter, while Christopher was being questioned. So social services came in, or they dealt with his son while he was being questioned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell us a little bit about this questioning, and what did they, just initially, before the MA makes a decision on what happened exactly, what was the state of her body in terms of wounds, stab wounds?
Well, they weren't able to make a total determination right there at the scene. But once the crime scene unit came in and started looking, they noted, that her chest had been riddled with wounds, several cuts and stab wounds. The side of her neck, there was a gaping wound on the side of her neck, which had created a significant amount of blood underneath her torso, her head and torso. And then one of the most significant things that the crime scene unit found, and that was Officer Sergeant Jessica Sundheim, is Angela was still wearing her night clothes. So she had on a tank top, and then she also had on a pair of turquoise underwear. And on the underwear, there was actually blood stains in the perfect shape of a knife blade. And so what Jessica Sundheim wrote in her report is that the assailant had obviously stopped for a minute and wiped off the blade on both sides of it on Angela's underwear.
Mm-hmm. And police determined very quickly that this is not a home invasion gone wrong. There's no theft. Mm-hmm. This is just a deeply personal murder, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it didn't really take long for them to know. Angela was not from North Dakota. She was a transplant from Alabama. She had moved there a few years earlier with her former husband, Richie Wilder Jr., because he joined the military. There's a military base there, Air Force base there in Minot. And so through kind of initial interviews with Christopher and, some of Angela's family members calling in, they realized that Angela really didn't have a network of friends in Minot. It was her and Christopher, her children, and the only real outside relationship she had with that was that with her ex-husband, Richie Wilder Jr. She didn't have a network of friends. She didn't have any family around her. And so it didn't take very long for them to figure out that it had to be personal, and there was only one or two people that could have possibly done it.
So right away they have to focus and eliminate Christopher Jackson. So they take him for questioning, and they get from him, they have to get it from somebody, the dating and marital history also of not only he and Angela, but also Richie and Angela. So tell us what they learn about this dating and marital history of all these folks.
Sure. So Christopher and Angela had been high school sweethearts. They had dated off and on throughout high school. And then Angela had kind of, when she graduated from high school, she had kind of moved on. She had went off to college for a little bit. She had had another relationship with someone. She had a daughter with that person. When that didn't work out, she moved back home, where she kind of reconnected with Richie Wilder Jr., whom she had known also in early childhood through their Mormon church. And, you know, once she reconnected with Richie Wilder Jr., it didn't really take long for them to decide that they wanted to date. And then from there, it really didn't take long for them to decide that they wanted to get married. And shortly after they got married, then that's when Richie joined the Air Force, and they moved up to Minot, North Dakota. And within about a year, they were already having severe marital issues. They'd only been married for about 2 years. They had a second child on the way. And shortly after their second child was born in March of 2012, they were in court to get a divorce. And so their divorce was finalized in the spring of 2013. And she traveled back to Alabama, and then her and Christopher reconnected. And then a few months later, she found out that she was pregnant with her and Christopher's baby. And so he moved up to Minot because Richie would not allow Angela to move back home to Alabama. And so Christopher moved up to Minot. And so that's where they had been for 2 years at the time of her murder in 2015.
Now, this Cynthia, what's her background, and what's her status with Richie at this time in November of 2015?
Sure. So in November 2015, Richie and Cynthia Wilder had been married for about 2 years. Coincidentally, right at about the same time that Angela was reconnecting with Christopher, Richie was connecting with Cynthia Wilder. At the time, they worked together at a vocational center in Minot. They were just kind of acquaintances at work. You know, they passed by each other as shift changes and things like that. But Cynthia was really curious about him. She had been kind of dating someone else, but it wasn't really working out. It was more like friends with benefits, and she had kind of gotten sick of that cycle. And so she started recognizing Richie, and so it was her that actually reached out to him. And that would have been actually New Year's Eve of 2012. And then within just a couple of months, Richie and Cynthia were living together in February. By March 2013, Cynthia was pregnant, and then by May 2013, I believe, they were married too. So in, you know, late spring, early summer of 2013, both Richie and Angela had essentially moved on to new partners.
Let's get back to the police investigating this, Sergeant Goodman and Detective Matisse. Mm-hmm. Once they talk to Christopher and once they establish, what do they gleam from Christopher Jackson in terms of just their gut feeling about his culpability or involvement in this murder, before we talk about their approach and their speaking with Richie Wilder?
Sure. So one of the first things that we talked about is Christopher didn't go into the house. And that was one of the first red flags for the detectives, is how could this man not have run into his house if there was a chance his family was hurt inside? And that was something that really stuck with them. They were really bothered by that. But then after about an hour of talking to Christopher, they knew that this man had just had his entire world upside down in a matter of minutes. They questioned him a second time. He submitted to a polygraph. His story never changed once. He passed the polygraph. And then everyone that they were talking to, all of Angela's family members, were all pointing towards Richie. And so it didn't take very long for the detectives to realize that it was probably more likely Richie, because him and Angela had a contentious past. They still had a contentious relationship because of custody issues and things like that. And so it really didn't take long to shift that focus at all away from Christopher.
Now, they record every bit of the interactions with Richie. So Richie is informed. They go to inform him about what has happened with his wife. So they're getting his reaction to this news as well. And they're also gauging and noting and studying his reaction to everything that they're going to ask him about this investigation, since they're keying in as a next logical suspect in all of this. So What does Richie say? How does he act? Give us a little bit, as you do in the book, a scene on how he reacts to the police questioning him.
Sure. So Richie was brought down to the police station actually just a few hours after Christopher Jackson was, and they were actually seated in rooms right next to each other, although neither of the men knew it at the time. But Richie kind of walked in with an air of confidence about him. He had kind of alluded to the police that he'd heard maybe a snippet here or there, something was going on at his ex-wife's house, but he wasn't really sure. His wife had, at the time, Cynthia Wilder, had dropped off their older daughter that Angela and Richie shared together, had dropped off their older daughter at the elementary school across from Angela's house. Cynthia had called Richie to let him know that there was police tape over, there were police cars over there. But, you know, Richie, when he came into the police department and sat down with detectives, he just figured it was another day in the life of Angela to have police cars all around her house. It's just how Angela lived her life. There was always drama going on around her. So when he was finally told that Angela had been murdered, he showed absolutely no reaction whatsoever. He literally just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, "Oh, really?" And that was a huge red flag for them. And the detectives immediately pounced on it, you know, and said, "Hey, listen, we know that your ex-partners, your ex-spouses, but when you find out something like this happens to someone that you once loved, there is a visceral reaction that should happen here." And once they kind of called him on that, and then, you know, another thing that they saw right away is that Richie had what appeared to be a fresh scratch on his face.
Right.
And they knew already that Angela had likely fought pretty hard for her life. She had broken fingernails. You know, the crime scene unit had found that. And so right away when Dave Goodman saw that scratch on his face, it was like a, you know, just right away, something happened here. You know, and Richie really, really never answered any question directly. He kind of went back and forth. He went in circles. He mumbled. He stuttered. All the signs of someone who just wasn't telling the truth. And it was very obvious. And then once they kind of started to tell him, "Hey, it doesn't look good for you here," then he got real nervous. His legs started pumping up and down. He started wringing his fingers together, swallowing hard. You know, it was very obvious that he was hiding something.
At this first interview that he spoke to police, what does he say about Christopher, and how does he sort of direct their suspicions towards Christopher initially?
Sure. Well, he first of all says that Christopher is a nice guy, that the two children that he shared with Angela, as far as, you know, Christopher becoming their stepdad one day, he was fine with that. How he kind of manipulated and turned it around to how Christopher might have done something is by painting Angela as someone who may have deserved to have something like this happen to her, that he could understand if Christopher had done something like this, because Angela was difficult to live with, a difficult person. She caused problems for basically everyone who came around her. And I think that's what they tried to do is that Angela causes relationship issues with many people, including Christopher, and therefore he could understand if Christopher had done something like this.
They also press him many times when he tries to cite examples, but without any specifics. So they're not easy on him. They're sort of pressing him when they see that he is rattled and not so confident. But they really don't get too much out of him, except now they have to get a search warrant for his wife's vehicle. Why is that? Tell us about what they have to get a warrant for and why.
Sure. Well, they acted very quickly. They didn't waste any time. They got warrants secured for Richie's vehicle, Cynthia's vehicle, their apartment, their electronics, Christopher's electronics, Christopher's car, his computers, everything like that. And so that afternoon, the same afternoon that Angela's body was found, they were at Cynthia Wilder's elementary school that she taught kindergarten at, checking her vehicle. And that was at, 3:30 in the afternoon. Angela Wilder's body was found at, shortly after 7 a.m. And so within just a, you know, by the end of the day, they were up there already executing all of these warrants.
They also have to speak to Cynthia as well, because there is a possibility that he has to, you know, when he spoke, he also mm-hmm. had an alibi for that evening. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the alibi. And now, of course, the detectives need to speak to her, see what she has mm-hmm. to say.
Yeah, so Richie's alibi was that he worked that night. He was working as a CNA at Trinity Hospital. His alibi is that he worked from 7 to 11 p.m. that night, and that he went directly home afterwards and that he never left his house again. His wife corroborated that story later that afternoon. Cynthia Wilder said that they were home in bed, that one of their children had woken up twice during the middle of the night, and she had tended to those while Richie was still fast asleep. She said that he was home the entire night. They were both very steadfast in saying that he never left the house that night.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. So, CJ, now they had this mm-hmm. opportunity to speak to Cynthia, his wife, mm-hmm. and to Richie. Now, how did they proceed with their investigation from there, given the information that both of these people gave them? Tell us about the vehicle, search of the vehicle.
Sure. So while they were searching the vehicle, they had Cynthia Wilder in the principal's office at Lewis and Clark Elementary School, which I mentioned she taught kindergarten. She basically had the same reaction as Richie. She had heard some things here and there about it, that something was going on at Angela's house. She had seen the police cars that morning, but didn't really think that much about it. She said the same thing as Richie. Didn't surprise her that Angela would have police cars over there. And then also when she was told that Angela was found dead, there was, again, no reaction whatsoever. And, you know, she reiterated that Richie had been home all night. And so the police knew right away. But her reaction, too, and it's noted in Detective Matisse's report, is that Cynthia was shaking. She was very nervous. They knew she was very nervous. And while they're talking to her, the crime scene unit is out searching her Honda Pilot, and it's pristinely clean everywhere except one spot on the passenger side door panel. And it's just a very small, very, very small spot of like a reddish-brown stain. Nothing else stood out in the car from that. And so they did end up swabbing that for a sample to send to the Bismarck crime lab for testing.
Now, you mentioned about that they knew that were broken fingernails from Angela from the crime scene. And so there was also, mm-hmm. they were awaiting the DNA results from that as well.
Mm-hmm. The medical examiner had taken DNA from underneath Angela's fingernails, and then they had that reddish-brown stain that they had taken a swab of, and both of those went to the crime lab for testing for DNA, and it was about two or three weeks after that they got those results back.
And what were those results?
The DNA underneath Angela's fingernails was Richie Wilder Jr.'s. And the stain that was in Cynthia Wilder's Honda Pilot was, in fact, blood, and it was Angela Wilder's blood.
Now, as a result of this, what happens in terms of Richie, his attorney, this Kerry Rosenquist, mm-hmm. and in terms of trying to account for the first interview that he had where police basically are accusing him of this murder? What's his reaction? Mm-hmm. His lawyer is there. What does he have to say to police?
So Richie was arrested, you know, almost 5 weeks to the day after Angela's murder. And when he was first arrested, he didn't say anything. He wouldn't say anything. He wouldn't talk to anybody. But then he got a little bit antsy sitting in jail. And so in March of 2016, the state's attorney, Kelly Dillon, and Dave Goodman got word from Richie's lawyer, Kerry Rosenquist, that Richie had a story to tell. And so they sat down with Richie and his lawyer, I believe it was March 2016, and the detectives just kind of sat and listened to Richie, kind of spill this story. And the story was that him and Christopher had met at Longfellow Elementary School when exchanging the kids one day. And Christopher kind of pulled Richie aside to tell him that, you know, things weren't going real well with him and Angela. He wanted out, but he wanted custody of his son, Carter. And so he wanted to enlist Richie in helping him get full custody. And so he told Richie that Angela was cheating on him, and he came up with a plan that if Christopher and Richie could catch Angela in the act of cheating, then Richie could testify for Christopher on his behalf, and then Christopher could in turn testify for Richie that Angela had taken the kids out of the state, so that both men could get custody of their kids and not have to share it with Angela anymore. And so Richie told the detectives that Christopher had given him a burner phone. He had given him two pictures of Angela and Christopher and the kids out of state, which they were not supposed to do according to the divorce agreement and child custody arrangements. And Richie was just to wait until Christopher called him and told him that it was time to go to catch Angela in the act of cheating.
And so this, he was ready to go. If this didn't happen right away, but within days, he did get a call. Tell us about the call and what he did.
Yes, so on November 12th, it would have been, well, it actually would have been the early morning hours of November 13th, as Richie claimed, about 1:30 in the morning, Christopher called him on the burner phone and said, it's time to do it. And so Richie didn't know what was going to happen, but he drove out to Walmart and he picked up Christopher, and him and Christopher drove back to Angela and Christopher's house. And Richie said that him and Christopher, you know, walked into the house and everything was quiet. It was dark. You know, they made their way down the little hallway into the master bedroom, where they opened up the door and found that it was dark. And there was a, you know, little bit of light from a TV playing in the corner, but it looked like two people were in the bed. And so at this point, Richie says to the detectives that he's convinced that Christopher is telling the truth, that Angela really is cheating on him, on Christopher. And so according to Richie, Christopher walked over to the bed and he pulled the bedding back. But instead of another man laying with Angela, it was actually a body pillow. So there was nobody actually there with Angela. But Richie continued with the detectives and said, but that didn't seem to deter Christopher. And in fact, what Christopher did is that he went over to Angela's side of the bed and just began kind of, and Richie pantomimed this with his handcuffed hands to the detectives, that Christopher just basically started doing a pumping motion. And then Richie kind of assumed that it must have been him stabbing her, because then he began to see Angela's blood coming out. And then Christopher, you know, and then Angela started to fight back, and then Christopher pulled her down to the floor and kept stabbing her, to which point Richie valiantly ran over and, you know, intervened. And while Christopher took a break, he checked Angela's pulse. And according to Richie, this is how he got the scratch on his face. She reached up, scratched his face, and said, Richie, I love you. Yeah. Then Richie got up and ran outside the room while Christopher evidently, allegedly, continued stabbing Angela.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then he said he waited in the living room to confront him, mm-hmm. saying, what did you do that, man? Something mm-hmm. like that. So just a continuum of this, as you write, a preposterous story.
Mm-hmm.
What was Sergeant Goodman, and what was his reaction to this story?
Goodman is fascinating to watch in what he does. He kind of just sat there stoically. He'd throw in a question here or there, you know, just to see if he could elicit anything additional, or, you know, just to see if anything from the get-go made sense about Richie's story. But then he just kind of sat back and waited for Richie to finish. And then he kind of dropped a little bit of a bombshell on him.
And what was that bombshell?
Well, Richie had claimed that he went to pick up Christopher from work at his lunch break at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that he brought Christopher back just a short time later to Walmart. Well, everybody knows that there's cameras everywhere in Walmart. Well, everybody except Richie apparently knows that.
Yeah.
And so Goodman had just received an additional batch of security footage from the Walmart security team the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had spent hours the night before watching this video, and it proved that Christopher never left Walmart that night. And so they knew right away that Richie was lying, and he confronted Richie with that his story didn't make sense, because there was no way that Christopher left And shortly after that, then Richie's lawyer, Rosenquist, then said, hey, you can stop whenever you want. And then that effectively ended the interview.
Yeah, so they confront him about that. And now as well, due diligence, these detectives have to check out Christopher. Well, they have to check out Richie's story. As preposterous and implausible as it is, they have to check it out. And in the process, they tell Christopher about Richie's story. So he is defiant about that completely. Meanwhile, Richie's defense team hires their own private investigator, this guy named Ross Rolshoven. And so now Richie and his defense attorney are now telling this guy how things went down. And he is not just accepting every story as well. So tell us a little bit about this character, Ross Rolshoven, and his investigation as he's hired by Richie's defense team.
Yeah, so he was actually hired. He was actually hired just a few days before Richie and his lawyer sat down with the detectives for the first time and told the story about Christopher giving him a phone and pictures and things like that. And so Ross Rolshoven, he's out of Grand Forks. He's a fantastic detective. He works mainly on, you know, things that happen in the oil fields around North Dakota and Minnesota. But he has his fair share of federal murder cases under his belt as well. So they had really hired the best of the best in him to try to find any possible way that Richie Wilder was not guilty of murdering Angela Wilder. But by the time Ross met with Richie face-to-face, Richie had determined that the original story he went with wasn't going to work anymore. So he had come up with a new one by the time Mr. Rolshoven was there meeting with him. This time, Richie claimed that while Christopher wasn't there and he wasn't the one who murdered Angela, he was in fact the one who orchestrated it in an effort to frame Richie. And so at this point, Richie is claiming that there was an Hispanic man and an African-American man at Angela's house that night. Christopher had indeed called him on his burner phone, but for whatever reason, Richie had gone down to the house. But when he walked into the house, he found Angela on the floor already dead. At this point, someone came up behind him and stuck something in his back and made him stand up and walk outside. The African-American man and the Hispanic man both told him that if he told anyone what he saw, they would kill him and his family. And so now he knew he hadn't recognized those two men before, but now he did. It was a new cellmate that he had just gotten named Paul Madrilis, and he was confident, and now he was telling everybody that Paul Madrilis had actually been the one to murder Angela and was hired as a hitman by Christopher Jackson.
Yeah. So this ongoing conspiracy to try to undo what he had already done, also this is also one of the factors is that all of these phone calls and all electronic devices would be later be able to be accessed, but also any contact on phones with Richie in prison with his mother, Geneva, or with his wife, Cynthia, were also recorded as well, weren't they?
Yep. Yes, and he made plenty of them. any chance Richie could get, he was on the phone. And at this point, he had actually thought anyways that he had recruited another cellmate who was eventually released from jail to do some bidding for him against Paul Madrilis.
So briefly, not to give this too much credibility, but basically what did he have these people, what did he attempt to have these people do in terms of his taking the heat off him as a murderer? What grand scheme did he have to be able to do that?
Well, he thought that because Paul Madrilis was actually let out on bond as well. And so that left Richie still in prison by himself, you know, in jail by himself. And he had made another connection with another man named Adam Monsigue while he was in jail. And Richie thought that Adam Monsigue was just kind of a puppet that he could kind of control. And so what he did was Richie is actually the one who bailed out Adam Monsigue. Actually, Cynthia Wilder is the one who did that on Richie's direction. Bailed out Adam Monsigue. And I think eventually what it was believed to be supposed to happen is that while Richie was working on the inside to help Adam Monsig and any charges he had against him, which we now know Richie had no power to do that, clearly. Adam Monsig was probably supposed to kill Paul Madrilis, write out a suicide note, and make it look like he had committed suicide because he couldn't live with the guilt of killing Angela Wilder. But Adam Monsig never got to that point, thank goodness, and it's pretty much speculated that he had never intended to either, that he was just stringing Richie along and getting some financial benefits during that. But as soon as Richie actually started telling people in jail that Adam Monsig was a hitman for him, Adam Monsig said, no more. I'm not involved in this at all. So once more, Richie's mouth got him in trouble.
And all the meanwhile, you document all of the desperate attempts by this guy. Number one, he thinks he's a really bright guy, and then he's much smarter mm-hmm. than the inmates that he's dealing with. And yet he's manipulating his mother and his wife to mm-hmm. be able to bail out these guys, and he's telling them that he's very, very confident, his wife and his mother, that he should be able to get these charges dealt with. So he's a consummate liar. That's evident here. So the thing is that he is desperate to be able to get things done before a certain deadline. He needs to get this Paul Madrilis gone, but then he's arrested again, and then he needs to get this done before he's incarcerated again, he believes. So you document all of this Three Stooges of crime here, but eventually he goes to trial with Judge mm-hmm. Gary Lee. So tell us a little bit about this trial.
Sure. Well, you know, I think all along, from the time he was arrested in December 2015 till the time he actually went to trial in December of 2016, I think Richie thought this was just a game to be played. I think he really thought that there's no way that he'd be convicted of this, that he could explain anything away, that no one saw through the lies that he was telling. And so really, you know, his trial was supposed to last about 2 weeks. It lasted about 3 days because his lawyer didn't put on any witnesses. He didn't provide any defense whatsoever, actually. He didn't do anything. He didn't give jurors any glimpse or any opportunity to understand what might be an alternative theory, you know, even though it was very clear that Richie was guilty, but certainly his defense could have done something, but they didn't. And so this trial lasted for about 3 days, and it was all the prosecution, and the jury was out for less than an hour to come back and convict him of murder.
Yeah. It's fascinating, too, that he did do what could be considered a vigorous cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses. However, mm-hmm. When it came time, even in his opening statement, it was inadequate and bizarre, as you write. Closing statement mm-hmm. as well, and this idea that he wouldn't even mount a defense, mm-hmm. it was, as you say, surprising and shocking.
Yeah, it was, you know, just allowing Richie to kind of continue to spout these conspiracy theories, you know, of a fiance and contract killers, and you know, it was I write in the book, it was a thing out of the stories he was telling was a thing out of movies. And it was just very surprising that, you know, that his lawyer didn't try to do something to change that trajectory of Richie just constantly digging holes for himself over and over and over again, deeper and deeper and deeper every time.
You write that it's also odd that either the attorney either knew or as Cynthia had said, that Richie claimed later, because I'm jumping ahead, that the Rosenquist had suggested the story. However, mm-hmm. it seemed that like unlikely that would be. However, you say that it's also very odd that he would have sat through, you know, two preposterous stories mm-hmm. that were super implausible.
Right.
And yet still defend this guy at trial. Did Richie, just for those people listening, the prosecution thought that Richie might really want to take the stand. Did Richie mm-hmm. take the stand?
No. No, not at all. They were very surprised by that, the prosecution was. And I, you know, and that might be the one time that his lawyer did say, "You're done talking now. We've
Yeah.
enough talking." Yeah.
The evidence they did have was essentially some damning evidence was the two interviews with Ritchie lying and being caught in a lie and then being told by Goodman and confronted by Goodman and Matisse. So it was very, very telling, compelling, and damaging. You write that right after, though, Cynthia, people didn't really notice that Cynthia was sitting in the court right behind the defense table. How did they react when Ritchie was sentenced to this life without parole? What was Cynthia's reaction, and how did they respond to each other, knowing it was unlikely they would see each other again?
She was very emotional in the courtroom. Her sister had to, you know, kind of calm her down. She was very emotional in the hallway when interviewed by reporters. She was still maintaining that there's no way Richie could have done it, that he was home with her all night, how much she loves his how much he loves his children, what a great man he is. She was still singing his praises. And but you know, with I don't think that as far as like police records go, there are no additional recordings that I have picked up anyways of the two of them talking after he was convicted, because very shortly afterwards she had some more to say herself, and it wasn't very long before you know.
Let's talk about her behavior right after this man that she stands up for, that she supports. She's there in the courtroom crying over. What does she do shortly after?
Well, she not to go back too far, but and I won't belabor this, but Richie was arrested in December of 2015. By January of 2016, Cynthia was already sleeping with someone else. She had already started a relationship with someone else and reaching out to an ex-boyfriend and starting up a new relationship. By the time Richie was convicted, just a couple of days later, she was going out on the town with one of her ex-lovers, Matt Walters.
Now, what does he tell? What is he told by Cynthia? And then how does it get to the point where the police find out about some of these conversations?
Sure. So while Richie sat in jail, Cynthia and Matt began communicating again over Facebook Messenger. And it was Cynthia who reached out to him to facilitate that sort of reconnection. And, you know, she would drop hints here and there of, you know, how she felt about how things were going, how she felt about Richie being in jail awaiting trial for the murder of his ex-wife. You know, and Matt would kind of say things here and there too, like, you know, how stupid was he to think about doing this? And one of the things that Matt said was, how stupid was it of Richie to use a knife to do this? And Cynthia wrote back and said, essentially, it wasn't supposed to be a knife, supposed to be a gun. And this automatically made, you know, the hairs on the back of Matt Walters' neck kind of stand up, saying,
Right.
wow, she's been telling me for a long time she knows nothing about this. So he kind of let it go for a little bit, but then she kept kind of dropping these weird things here and there. So he finally reached out to mine at the police department because he did not want to have anything to do with it. If she had truly been involved with it, he did not want to be drawn into it as well. And so within a few weeks then, they made him a confidential informant. And so what Cynthia thought was going to be a really fun date out on the town with her former lover was actually Matt Walters sitting with a recording device in his car and on his phone to record everything she said.
And she did say much more damaging things, didn't she? And you have this
She did.
recorded.
She did. She did. She basically laid it all out for Matt Walters how, yes, Richie absolutely did kill Angela. Not only that, but because Angela deserved it. Cynthia was still very much adamant that it had to happen. She revealed that her and Richie had planned it for 2 years, that she indeed actually had been stalking Angela. She had been sitting outside her house at night to find out when Angela would be home alone and Christopher would be gone at work. You know, she said things like, you know, Richie got sloppy. She was mad at him for getting sloppy. She was mad at him for leaving DNA. She was very explicit in what she would have done differently to make sure that there hadn't been any DNA there. And it was just sort of like this verbal volcano of everything that the detectives had been waiting to hear. And it was just an avalanche that just came out of Cynthia. And within a few days, Cynthia was also arrested.
You talk about the trial as well, because Kelly Dillon, the prosecutor, is just dying to be able to prosecute her. And also, at this trial, she has an opportunity to cross-examine Cynthia on the stand as well. So she's really wants this opportunity. Just tell us about this trial.
Sure. So it kind of went back and forth, because initially Cynthia wanted to go with not guilty, but then she was eventually talked into maybe you should submit an Alford plea, which is essentially admitting that the state has enough information against you to probably find you guilty. And so Cynthia was up on the stand, and Kelly Dillon was asking her, you know, about all these things that supposedly Richie and Cynthia had accused Angela of. They had accused her of physically, psychologically, emotionally abusing their children. And so Kelly Dillon asked Cynthia Wilder, give us an example of what Angela did for any of these things. And the only example she could give was when Angela and Richie were married several years prior. There were no other examples. And it was it. And the other thing is that Cynthia never said she was sorry. She never expressed any remorse. And it's the judge had no choice but to hold her accountable for that.
She had been offered a plea agreement, but she declined.
She was.
They didn't expect the reaction from the judge. What was the judge's reaction?
Sure. The state had asked for a 25-year sentence. Her lawyer had asked for a 10-year sentence, I believe. And the judge gave her life without parole.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned, just as an aside, Richie was arrested. They noticed he was trying to escape, so he was arrested, convicted of attempted escape. Along with her sentence and convictions were her aiding and abetting him in his plan to escape.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yep. That one she did admit to.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, all is said and done, these both people are going to be doing life without parole. You reached out to Cynthia in prison. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So we began emailing in October of 2018, which was actually just about 3 months after she was originally sentenced. So she had only been in prison for about 3 months. And we exchanged emails for several months, and then I eventually went and visited her in prison. And throughout the course of our email correspondence, she also kind of divulged some new information to me. She actually admitted that she knew that Richie had done this. She, you know, knew that he came home and had tried to clean himself off and things like that. And then by the time I got to visit her in prison, she actually added on that she had given him a duffel bag to get rid of his bloody clothes and the weapon that night.
Right. What else did you... You didn't just contact her for that information, yet that's very valuable information that you wanted. What else did you find from this correspondence? What did she impart to you about her life and maybe even motivations?
Sure. I mean, she had, you know, she had a troubled upbringing. Her relationship with her mom was not good. Her mom was kind of promiscuous. Didn't spend a whole lot of time at home, you know. And, you know, Cynthia always vowed that she wasn't going to be like that, but she actually did kind of turn out like that. You know, she had been married prior to Richie, and she had cheated on him numerous times over and over again. And she believed, you know, in the end, I think she was easily impressionable, but in the end, you know, she believed everything Richie told her about Angela, even though most of it was lies. And Cynthia never bothered to actually... Cynthia and Angela actually never talked to one another. She just hated Angela because of what Richie said about her. But she never actually knew Angela. And the issue that I still have here is that Cynthia still firmly believes that Angela deserved to die based on lies and innuendos from a manipulative person. And she doesn't believe that she deserves to be in prison because she swears that she isn't the person who wielded the weapon against Angela. And she has no remorse at all for her involvement in this. You know, it's interesting to, you know, and then, you know, one of the things that we find out during my research and during the detective's work is that Richie was cheating on Cynthia with at least three other women. And that's something she never wanted to believe either. But when I visited her in prison,
right.
I told her point blank, I saw all of that. He did. He was doing that. And he manipulated you too. And I hope that there's a day that Cynthia does come to realize that she was manipulated and that hopefully she does have remorse someday for participating in something like this.
It's very interesting what you said to Matt, too, in regards to empathy or remorse, that she felt no emotion. She said, if my grandma died, I wouldn't feel anything either. She remarked that she had a lack of normal emotion, didn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that comment alone, I think, was a little more for show for Matt Walters to kind of show how tough she was. She definitely has emotions. She definitely has emotions, but they're just with this particular situation, she just doesn't, there's nothing there that makes her understand the enormity of what she participated in.
Yeah, yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming on, CJ Wynn, and talking about Wilder Intentions, Love, Lies, and Murder in North Dakota. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this incredible book. Is there a website or a Facebook page that people might take a look at this book and find out more information?
Yes, absolutely. You can go to my author page. It's CJ Wynn, author. And you can get the book on blacklionpublishing.com or at amazon.com.
That's great. Thank you so much, CJ Wynn,
so
Wilder
much,
Intentions.
Thank you so much, Dan. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great night. Good night.
Okay, you too. Good night.